This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. During his presidential campaign, Donald Trump railed against the North America Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, blaming it for hurting American workers. He said, quote, "Our jobs have fled to Mexico and other places. I'm going to renegotiate with NAFTA, and if we can't make a good deal, we'll make a new deal." He also called NAFTA a, quote, "total disaster" and, quote, "one of the worst deals ever." But just a few months into his term, Trump, upon realizing the complexity of undoing a 23-year-old agreement between the USA, Mexico, and Canada, backtracked and said rather than terminating, he was now going to renegotiate NAFTA. Dozens of top corporate CEOs in late May sent Trump a letter urging him to restrict his interference to an update of the trade agreement and to do it swiftly in order to minimize uncertainty in markets. Indeed, most members of Congress, Republicans and Democrats alike, are happy to see NAFTA remain untouched. But what about ordinary Americans? In a recent editorial, my guest Tobita Chow said, quote, "New NAFTA must put people and planet first." Mr. Chow is chair of the People's Lobby, an independent political organization, and an affiliate of People's Action based in Chicago, Illinois. He organizes a task force working toward a global minimum wage and is co-founder of the Moral Mondays Illinois campaign against state budget cuts. He's currently pursuing his Master's of Divinity at the Lutheran School of Theology at Chicago. Welcome to the program, Toby.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So one of the very few things Trump said that resonated with progressives during his campaign was what he mentioned on trade and free trade agreements in particular. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, which President Barack Obama was negotiating during the last few years of his tenure, Trump spoke out against that. He rightly accused Hillary Clinton of being for it before she was against it. And he spoke out against NAFTA. Would you say that on that one issue, he had it right?
I think he had it partially right. So what Trump correctly pointed out is that these free trade deals like NAFTA and TPP have been negotiated in a way that is severely biased to elite interests, the interests of multinational corporations, have left out all other competing interests, such as the interests of working people, both in the US and across the country, and other considerations like environmental concerns. And that's true both in the substance of the agreements and in how they've been negotiated, right? So you had a team of 500 corporate lawyers being able to go through TPP line by line, no similar consideration for labor or other civil society groups. So that's what he got right. And when he criticized these trade deals, that resonated not just with the conservative base, but also with a lot of people outside of the established conservative base, including a lot of progressives. What he got wrong was his analysis of why these deals are so toxic and what needs to be done about them, right? So his narrative was very much based on this nationalistic picture where he's portraying workers in other countries, in particular Mexico, sometimes China, as the enemies of American workers, as if workers in Mexico have somehow triumphed over workers in the US through deals like NAFTA, which of course isn't true. Right, NAFTA has been devastating to working people and small farmers in Mexico, just as it has been in the U.S. Right?
Perhaps even more so, one might argue.
Absolutely, yeah. If you look at the numbers, wages in Mexico have dropped 9% since NAFTA was enacted. Right, so the severe drop in wages, never recovered unemployment. 2 million small farmers lost their farms, lost their land, got displaced entirely. So it was devastating to people in Mexico. So the way that he portrays it as if the U.S. needs to win back the ground it lost against the people of Mexico is both like a wrong and immoral way of looking at it, and it completely detached from actual reality when you look at it.
So when he said he would terminate NAFTA, or basically pull the U.S. out of NAFTA, then backtracked and said, well, after basically speaking to advisors, he would renegotiate it. What do you think happened in the interim? Reality has hit Mr. Trump very hard on so many issues where suddenly he's realizing either that things are more complex and complicated than he thought, or that some of the people that are supposed, you know, that are basically his buddies, his fellow billionaires, don't like him wanting to undermine the things that they benefit from. So what do you think happened for him to change his mind from wanting to pull out of NAFTA to simply wanting to renegotiate and maybe in the end even just do some tiny tweaks to NAFTA?
Yeah, so, you know, the story that's been told is that one of his advisors came to him with a map of the states in the U.S. that would be hardest hit if NAFTA were simply undone, right? So states that exported a lot of goods to other NAFTA countries, in particular Mexico, and there were all of the strongest states like supporting Donald Trump, right? So at that point, he backed away, right? So I think that was a way of reality sitting in. The idea of undoing NAFTA is unrealistic, right? And, you know, progressives, we have been fighting these corporate trade deals for, I think, longer than Trump has been opposed to them. And we're very aware of the damage that they've done, right? But the solution is not to undo them, because the effect of NAFTA has been to closely integrate the economies of the three NAFTA countries to the point where destroying NAFTA would just cause a huge amount of chaos, problems with investment, create even more unemployment in all the countries. So that would be, the solution is not to like move us into that kind of anarchy by undoing NAFTA, right? The solution is to make NAFTA better, more progressive, more equitable, right?
So basically, just to interrupt you here, this is an agreement that sets rules for trade. The problem is that the rules have been written in favor of corporations and at the detriment of workers and the environment. Rewriting those rules in favor of people and the environment would actually benefit the most people.
That's correct, yes. The most outrageous part of trade deals like NAFTA, I think, is this thing called the ISDS, the Investor-State Dispute Settlement System. It basically boils down to a corporate court system where corporations can take a democratically elected government to court, say that this government has passed a law that is infringing on the corporation's rights to profit, and demand that the government pay penalties to the corporation. And this has happened on a number of occasions. Governments have been forced to pay tens of billions of dollars in penalties to corporations for passing laws democratically, usually environmental laws, right? So environmental laws that protect the environment, protect people from pollution, get punished, penalized in this corporate court system. So the most recent example is that TransCanada Corporation, based in Canada, demanded over $10 billion in damages from the U.S. government after the Obama administration, following the historic victory of the movement to stop Keystone XL pipeline, said that the Keystone XL pipeline would not go forward. And then the Canadian company behind that, TransCanada, took the U.S. government to this corporate court system demanding over $10 billion in damages. Which didn't come through once Trump got elected and gave it a green light. But that's an example of how these deals have baked into them this kind of anti-democratic, pro-corporate, anti-worker, anti-environment agenda. But what we do see in these trade deals that could potentially be useful for progressive purposes is that they are able to enforce rules across borders, right? Which means that this is a power that I think we are now in a historic opportunity to turn around and use for progressive politics, to take this enforcement power and use it to prevent corporations from fleeing across borders to violate, for example, the rights of workers or environmental protection in other countries. We need, in this age of globalization, the ability to hold corporations accountable across borders, because otherwise they're just going to flee to wherever they can exploit workers the most, abuse the environment the most.
So on this issue of the ISDS, I mean, basically a country that cancels a project decides to not pursue a project because it would hamper environmental problems or hurt ordinary people, it should not be penalized for doing so. And so getting rid of this court would be a good step in establishing, in allowing that sort of fairness to prevail?
Yes, that has to be a fundamental demand in these NAFTA renegotiations, that whatever the renegotiated NAFTA looks like, a red line has to be ISDS. Any future NAFTA that includes ISDS is a no-go, right? That is fundamental.
So that's one thing in terms of, protecting the sovereignty, if you will, of countries to make decisions based on considerations other than simply the market. But what about protecting ordinary people and workers? How does one tweak NAFTA so that corporations can't just say, well, we're just going to move our factory to Mexico because labor is cheaper there?
So I think this is maybe more than a tweak, but a fundamental transformation of how these trade deals work and how we think of them, right? What we can do is create clear, substantial rules, write them into this future NAFTA agreement, saying that in all countries that are part of NAFTA, we need to see these wage standards adhered to by all employers, by all multinational corporations, no matter where they're based, no matter where they're doing business. We need to see fundamental labor rights respected by all multinational corporations, no matter where they're doing business. We need to see environmental protections, standards around corporate taxation, right? We set these standards, make them central to this new NAFTA, and then we create an enforcement system to hold corporations accountable for violating these standards wherever they're doing business, right? Which means that a US corporation would be liable to penalties for violating these standards in the business it does in Mexico, for example.
So if countries were to set their minimum wages at a high standard and have those be relatively equal across all the countries in a agreement, then there's no incentive for corporations to go looking for cheaper labor.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So this is the best way that we can deal with the problem that we've been facing on a variety of issues for decades, which is this global race to the bottom, right? Where corporations pit different countries against each other and say, well, what country is going to make their workers work for the least amount of money? That's where we're going to set up shop, right? Setting up this race to the bottom between countries that really hurts everyone, right? It hurts people in the US, it hurts people in Mexico, it hurts people in Canada and around the world, right? The way we reverse that is by creating these floors in these international agreements, like under all workers, and lifting them up in a uniform way, right? That's good for everybody.
The CEOs, 32 CEOs of top corporations in the U.S., including Cargill, sent a letter to Trump in late May, basically saying that he should simply limit the scope of any changes he makes to a, quote, update, and that they are willing to work with Trump to modernize NAFTA. How generous of corporate CEOs to offer their help. What's the danger that corporate CEOs, who basically were the ones who helped write NAFTA in the first place, it doesn't make any sense that corporations would be the ones wanting to help him tweak it because their interests are the opposite of the interests of ordinary Americans, right?
Yeah, and they have they're already the ones who have written the trade agreements that we have, right? The help that they're offering is that they found new ways of exploiting people and violating democratic rights, right? So they found new ways in these international trade agreements to protect, you know, for example, intellectual property rights, which is a fancy way of talking about forcing working people to pay unnecessarily high prices for things that they need. Like, this is most outrageous around medicine, right? Protecting international and intellectual property rights around medicine means people pay much more than they have to for the medicine that they need, in some cases, to stay alive.
Right. Pharmaceutical companies have certainly taken great advantage of NAFTA. Now, the Trump administration has sent a letter to Congress informing Congress of its intent to renegotiate. And that basically gives them a 90-day period, a 90-day window within which to start this. What do you know about how the Trump administration intends to move starting at this point? I mean, one of the things that I can find is that they seem to be interested in tweaking it in the margins, updating the agreement to reflect the digital, the idea of digital trade, which was, you know, just in its infancy 23 years ago in 1994 when the agreement was first started. That doesn't sound like something that's going to raise the wages of people in the Rust Belt or Virginia or some of these parts of the country where people are struggling, does it?
No, it's all... All these tweaks are geared towards increasing corporate profits.
The exact opposite of what Trump basically promised.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, one way to look at what to expect in the new NAFTA is that it's going to be like a resurrected version of the TPP, right? All the things that were bad about the TPP and all the reasons why progressives oppose the TPP are, you know, expect them to be built into NAFTA, including, you know, one part of the TPP was that the government was moving to try to give more concessions to organized labor and to environmental groups and stuff like that. So there were more impressive looking clauses around labor and environment in the TPP. It seems like they're going to do the same thing in NAFTA. Right. But, you know, the devil is in the details. What you have to look to is like, how concrete are these rules and what are the enforcement mechanisms that are going to be put in place to make sure that multinational corporations get penalized for violating these rules? And what you should expect is they're going to be loosely written and that there will be no enforcement mechanism to actually give these rules real teeth.
What about the heads of state of Canada and Mexico? This is a three-nation deal, the North America Free Trade Agreement, so Canada, the U.S., and Mexico. What do you think the governments of Canada and Mexico are interested in? Because the U.S. can't just unilaterally renegotiate this. It was done together, you know, as three countries. Any update needs to involve all three countries.
Yeah, I think you should expect a similar dynamic in Canada and Mexico, where the corporations who have the most power in those countries will be in charge of formulating that country's negotiation position, right? Just like in the U.S., given that both Canada and Mexico have very neoliberal pro-corporate governments. One example of this is that this was like maybe a month or two ago, there was a senior official in the Mexican government, like maybe the foreign minister or something like that, said to the Trump administration, look, we need to work together through NAFTA. Don't take NAFTA apart. We need to work together as the NAFTA countries, because you don't understand how important Mexico is to the competitiveness of U.S. corporations. So, for example, said this Mexican official, U.S. car companies set up their factories in Mexico and are able to pay our workers here in Mexico very low wages. And then that helps the U.S. companies compete with, say, companies in China, right? So this Mexican official was basically offering up the workers in his own country saying that we're going to continue to make them work for extremely low wages. And we're telling you that this is going to help companies based in the US, right? So this is not an agenda that you should expect to promote the interests of workers in Mexico or workers in the US.
Finally, Toby, let's talk about the politics of supporting these free trade agreements. We should remind ourselves, the Democratic Party in the United States and really the world over, you're seeing center-left, and you have seen for many decades now, center-left parties that are liberal are the ones that have adopted these policies, which is why the term neoliberal is used to describe them. It should be the Democrats making a huge deal about how free trade agreements hurt ordinary Americans. And of course, we've had no politicians talk about it until this, out of left field, hard to pin down Republican for the last few years alone, Trump came about and tried to echo what he was hearing from ordinary Americans. Politicians have for far too long just assumed that we're not going to notice that it's these free trade agreements that are at the heart of why American jobs keep either getting outsourced to other parts of the world and wages keep stagnating. So how important is it for us to talk about this? Because until Trump came along, it was just some sectors of the grassroots left in the U.S. and the world over that were calling attention to NAFTA. I mean, when we recall when NAFTA was first signed, it was a Zapatista, it was the birth of the Zapatista movement in opposition to this free trade agreement in Mexico. And so left grassroots opposition to these free trade agreements has been the strongest voice against them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this needs to be a renewed priority for progressives in the current moment, because his anti-trade rhetoric, Trump's anti-trade rhetoric, was such a central part of his campaign, and I think such a central part of how he was able to appeal to his base and energize his base, in particular in these crucial Midwestern Rust Belt states and counties, which he was able to flip, and then that was sort of the key of how he won the Electoral College, right? So this is such an important part of Trump's path to victory. We need to prioritize formulating our progressive response on the question of globalization and what it's going to look like going into the future, right? We need a positive vision of globalization. Now, you mentioned
the Democrats. And on that note, I'm glad you brought that up, because back in the day before the September 11th attacks, the movements were characterized as anti-globalization, which frankly was a terrible term because it made grassroots movements out to be Luddites for, you know, being against globalization.
Yeah, that was, you know, that was sort of the mainstream liberal media's take on what was really an attempt by popular movements from around the country to formulate, like, what's our vision of globalization? Like, progressives have a very strong tradition of thinking globally, of thinking in terms of, like, how can we foster more cooperation among ordinary people, among workers across borders, right? So that is, you know, that perspective was in, you know, the 1999 WTO protests. But once the media got a hold of it, it became anti-globalization.
Well, Toby, I want to thank you so much for spending this time with us and for joining us today. We'll post a link to your article about NAFTA from our website. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
My guest is Tobita Chow, chair of the People's Lobby, co-founder of the Moral Monday's Illinois Campaign Against State Budget Cuts. He's currently pursuing his Master's of Divinity at the Lutheran School of Theology at Chicago. His recent article about NAFTA is entitled New NAFTA Must Put People and Planet First. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.